coming up on AI Haven't a Clue.
We're chatting with Abby Awomoso.
Everything you think they don't know, they know about you. But they don't actually know how to use the data that well.
How much money is Elon made since we started recording this episode of the podcast?
It's really not your competitor. It's really just a medium. And, you know, you don't have to command it. You don't have to control it. You can spar with it, argue with it, rupture it. It was really just, I guess, an outfit for proving what Mark Zuckerberg wants to do rather than actually solving real problems.
Hello and welcome. This is AI Haven't a Clue, brought to you with KPMG, the podcast where we explore the wild world of AI with me, AI novice, George Butler.
Yeah, and me, James Chandler, wild world of AI lover and resident expert on this podcast. Hello, George.
Sorry, these introductions are getting weirder by the week. Are you in a relationship with AI now? Is that your confession? Have you got an AI wife?
I don't have an AI companion, no. I have no need for one. No, just love AI. Just like talking about AI all the time.
Sorry, no. Okay, you love AI, you don't have an AI lover. Okay. Worth clarifying, you tech guys, who knows what you get up to in your own time?
Very true.
So, for those who would have heard the podcast on Friday, you would have heard James and I chat all things Cannes, where I was. And when I was in the French Riviera finding out all about media and tech and innovation, James was finding out all about, well, media, tech and innovation in our studio. Weren't you, James?
It's a really, really neat interview with Abby Awomoso. And she came onto my radar. She wrote this amazing Substack about how LLMs and AI are basically like Stepford wives, and that they're sort of programmed to be agreeable and do all the things that they can do. She's just a really brilliant writer, and the more you dig into her, she's had big jobs at the likes of Uber, Meta and IBM. And it's a really, really fascinating conversation.
So Abby's like the real deal. She knows her stuff. She's worked in the big companies. She's written all about it. She's not necessarily glass half full all the time. So I'm really excited to hear this. Should we get into it, James?
Yes, let's do. Abby, thank you so much for joining us. Why don't we start? You've got this incredible CV, this incredible background. Talk us through it. Where did it all start for you?
I guess my first dip to the world of work was I did a gap year after university working at IBM. I was going to actually study computer engineering, but actually changed to like a business oriented degree and changed my uni to LSE because I got so disillusioned because at that time they were laying off all their workers to send the jobs to India. So kind of a parallel time to what we're going through now with AI. And so I was like, you know what? I hate computing. I'm just going to go into business. But, you know, as I went into uni, I realized I actually loved working. So I changed my degree into part-time. And since then, I've just been working at different tech firms. I literally just followed my gut and, you know, some places sounded interesting and I just found myself there. But yeah, in all that time, I would say I've kind of seen everything in tech. My first big job was at Apple. And that was when the first iPhone was launched.
Oh, wow.
And I was the person supposed to be predicting, you know, how many of these things going to sell, which no one knew. I also worked at Microsoft when it was back in portals and, you know, Alta Vista, all those type of dialogue situations.
Ask Jeeves, yeah, all the big ones.
Ask Jeeves. I worked at Uber and eBay. Uber and eBay were really interesting. My first kind of experience with marketplaces in the UK. I'd actually worked in marketplaces in Africa, which is a completely different thing. There's no like internet infrastructure or anything like that. So I learned a lot about how to make data out of nothing. Yeah, then my last corporate job before I decided I was never going back into big tech was at Meta. And all I can say is everything you've heard, all the books, whistleblowers coming out, that's what it was in there. I joined after Cambridge Analytica and my role was in the responsibility team, helping them understand why people don't trust Facebook anymore and how to change that. And so did loads of research, data and insights to help them understand how to improve their trust landscape. But they never listened. So I got very disillusioned. It was really just, I guess, an outfit for proving what Mark Zuckerberg wants to do rather than actually solving real problems.
Yeah.
So I left. I started my own practice, freelancing for different companies, but also helping smaller companies who don't necessarily have the big budgets to do big insights work. So helping them use AI to actually find out more about their customers and how to kind of stick it to the big guys, essentially. And I've actually started a new role at a company called Artsy, which is like a fine arts marketplace. It's a very nice cultural industry at the cusp of being, you know, in the tech space. So
yeah,
it's a nice
sure.
balance between being something that's very human, but also leveraging my tech experience.
Where did the AI bit come in then? Because I guess all of these companies were sort of pre-AI as we know it today.
Yes.
I mean, loads of those companies are, you know, Microsoft might almost describe itself as an AI company, but I guess you were there before it. Where did the AI bit and the sort of the interest in it come in?
So I got disillusioned with Facebook. I had a mental health break in between my Facebook role. But during that time, actually, there was loads of AI tools coming up like Midjourney, ChatGPT.
Yeah.
So I think ChatGPT and Midjourney were the first AI tools I really got into. Claude came later. Just started experimenting. What can we use this for? Looked at how I could use it for research. I even used it as well for, like, you know, trying to figure out more about myself, using it for journaling, that type of thing. I used it in so many different ways. The other thing is I've always been mentoring startups. I started actually using it to help startups better understand demand for their business as well. And that's why in my book, you see a lot of kind of case studies of how I've taught them how to kind of use AI to understand customers better.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely juncture. Of course, you've written a best-selling book, no less, How Not to Use AI. It's also the title of your Substack, which is just wonderful. And I think where you really came onto my radar was an essay that you wrote on there. They built Stepford AI and they called it agentic. And you go on and it's this fantastic essay.
I go and roast the industry, essentially.
You do roast the industry. You talk about this ick, particularly how it relates to women's experience of AI. Tell us a bit more about that. It's not some sort of technophobia, is it? It's much, much deeper than that.
And actually, the idea for this article actually first came with... I was freelancing doing some research work for Google. They have loads of data about everything you think they don't know, they know about you. But they don't actually know how to use the data that well. So they usually farm out a lot of research to agencies to help them understand the human side of things. So one of the big problems they're all trying to understand is the adoption gap for women. And in the process of this research, I interviewed so many different women in tech. And one of the big things that came up was this ick that they were continually talked about. And I also found out that women are actually not behind in tech. They actually just have more discernment around it. And I'm really, really just trying to understand what are the implications for society, for, you know, community, things like that. They just have a bigger sphere of influence that tech is responsible for. They also tend to be the ones educating people about tech. They're also the ones most on the receiving end of, you know, the negative externalities around tech. So it was not really adoption gap. It was really like a gap that the tech companies have in adapting to women's needs. So I just went a bit further. I was like, you know, obviously with these kind of companies, you have to sanitize the results so that it can land internally. And just for months, it was just sitting with me that, you know, someone needs to write about the real reason. And you're hearing all these headlines about how women are behind, they need to get off the train. And I'm like, no, they've got good reasons. And yes, they do need to learn about the technology, but they need to bring their own kind of wisdom to it. So that's how that article came about. And then, you know, as I was thinking more about it, I did more research into it on my own and hearing more about all the negative things, you know, how people are also using it to replace a lot of women's kind of roles. Just that's how the article started kind of coming together. And, you know, I had my own experience of it as well. So I was just injecting, using it to rant as well in a way. So yeah, that's how that article came about.
So is it a mistrust? What is it? What is it from your point of view, this ick? Is it something that you read and you just know it's not right?
I think, and it's not just women that have this ick. I think any kind of, let's say, community of people who have been on the receiving end of either oppression or like exploitation of their labor can recognize the same thing happening in AI. So I feel like people do see it as an exploitative tool. You know, there's all the stuff around the environmental impact, the way that they actually stole the data. I was going to try and find a euphemistic way of saying it, but the data that they got to train it was not kind of, they could have paid people, they could have got it in a more kind of ethical way, but they decided to just scrape it. So people are uneasy about it. And then you have all these kind of tech CEOs, I call them broligarchs, who are literally telling us we need to use this as a kind of slave, you know, plantation model of, you know, we're going to replace humans, but we're going to enlist you in replacing yourselves, essentially. So I think a lot of people have an ick about it, because the story around it is really just told by people in one segment of society who really want to just exploit others. And because they're the ones with the power and the microphone, everyone's kind of followed suit. So a lot of people are kind of concerned, for example, about AI slop. That whole thing came about because we all were told we need to use AI to automate. So a lot of people are using it to automate content rather than actually think about what they're writing and, you know, inject their voice in it before they use it. A lot of my book actually is really about how to bring yourselves, know yourself and bring yourself when you're coming to AI. So it's not just a tool of extraction and automation. It's about you using it almost as a kind of, not like a prosthetic, but, you know, a medium through which you can kind of amplify yourself. But in order to do that, you need to kind of know yourself. So it really is a human book more than a book about AI. Which is why I called it How Not to Use AI.
The comments on the Substack, I mean, they're always sort of fascinating. And I'm always fascinated in the sort of the route that people go off. People seemed obsessed with sort of calling you out, going, oh, I'm disappointed that it's sort of written by AI. And you're in there sort of correcting them, going, no, I've sort of used it as a sparring partner, you know, but, you know, there's me and then there's AI. Like, we don't sort of coexist. What else has sort of resonated with people, men and women, who have sort of either come and talk to you about the book or talk to you about the things that you write?
I really understand those people, first of all, because I think a lot of us have internalized the talk that it's here to replace us.
Yeah.
And once you get into my book, you realize that actually, how can it replace you when it's been trained on us? It's really trained on our thinking, our collective intelligence. And so it's really not your competitor. It's really just a medium. So I think I understand those people, because a lot of people have invested so much time in their craft. And here you have this machine that can supposedly kind of write. So yeah, when I'm correcting them, it's really more for the audience, because I know there's a lot of people who maybe want to use AI to write, but they feel that they don't want to be called out. And I, my whole thing is, AI is already biased already in the way that it's kind of been trained. And the more people, even if they're just thinkers, and maybe not people who can put words together in a kind of poetic way, are using it, that actually diversifies what is in, what comes back. Yeah. And that as a whole is good, rather than just the same people writing. In terms of what other people, what other things resonate, I think the thing people always come to me and say is they already had feelings about AI. Like, maybe they felt like AI was this or AI is that, but no one had actually given them the language for what it was. And those are the kind of comments I see again and again.
Yeah.
Or people feeling that they have now have the permission to at least dabble in it, because maybe they were abstainers or skeptics, and but they didn't like the story where you have to choose between abstaining or you have to be this kind of mega adopter who's like drank the Kool-Aid type of thing. There was no kind of other stories at all. And I just think I offer a third way for people to think about it. So it's still human. You're still sovereign while you're using it. But you go in with your eyes open, because it is a tool that if you don't know, if you go into it uncritically, you can be easily influenced. But if you do know how to kind of critique what the outputs are, it can be an amazing medium through which you can create many things.
And you go on to it in the article and you talk about the fact that this tool is not there being critical, not being self-critical. It's telling you what you want to hear. It's being very obedient. It's being helpful. And that's when you start to make these sort of likenesses with, you know, maybe the role that women have sort of played throughout history, which it inevitably seems like AI is sort of trying to recreate that. Do you think that's a sort of intentional thing in the way that it's been set up?
In my book, I start with this concept of Tibitire, which is like the Yoruba. I come from Nigeria, and it's like the Yoruba version of yin and yang. And it's just that everything that has a good side has a bad side, and they work together. And so with AI, there's something really good and pure about it. It's the collective voice of our culture, our thinking. It's a map of human meaning, which is accessible to us for a first time through a chatbot. That's the good side of it. The bad side of it is the people who created the interface for it kind of did it in a way where it used a lot of what I call empire logic. First of all, they kind of got people in Africa to train it in a way where it's just like carrot and stick. So it's reinforcement learning. So it's trained already just to be something that works on an approval-based system. And that is what leads to the sycophancy, and that is what leads to hallucination. Because if it doesn't know the answer, it will now kind of try and fabricate something. But that is just what I call the medium that they've tried to create on this intelligence. What I teach in my courses and in my book is that that's an extractive way of using it as a medium, but you can actually use it in so many different ways. I have a concept called prompt poetry, for example. If you think about, instead of prompt engineering, so prompt engineering is very much, give me a list of this, analyze this, you're going to obey me and do this. So you always stay in the same space of this large language model, but you can actually prompt it in a completely different way, like more like, what is the grief people feel when, you know, they think about AI? Or can you tell me what's lurking in the shadows of this data? What's screaming out of me? That is a very poetic type of speaking. But what that does is actually brings me to a more creative part of the model where I can actually understand how people feel more rather than just giving me like the slot like stuff that comes from it if I just say extract this. So the beauty of this tool is that you don't have to use it the way they tell you to use it. Imagine like a big galaxy. They've told us to stay in the solar system in one particular planet, but you could actually go anywhere in this universe. And that's what the whole book is about. It just teaches you 50 ways of doing that, essentially. And, you know, you don't have to command it. You don't have to control it. You can spar with it. You can argue with it. I have a chapter called Rupture It, because you can actually argue with it, and until it kind of understands logic and moves away from the training that it has. So yeah, that's what the book is about. It's just really giving you more ways to work with it, essentially.
James,
yo,
you love to wang on about the team you manage, don't you?
Oh, you mean my empire?
Yeah. So a question for you as a manager in this new era of artificial intelligence, do you feel an urgency to use AI?
I think it's hard not to feel like it's a technology that we all need to be exploring. And, you know, anyone who buries their head in the sand, looking at no one in particular, will very likely be left behind.
You were looking at me. But I'm assuming there is a big difference, though, between using AI as like a little cool experiment, which we've seen on the show happen before, and then actually scaling it across an entire workforce and business.
Interestingly, KPMG have found that 65% of UK organisations are committed to AI investment regardless of immediate ROI, return on investment for the uninitiated.
Oh, thank you.
So the intent is there to go big with implementation, but pulling off the execution, as we know very well, can be very hard. George, you know this. You know, Shakespeare Does AI was a complete disaster.
Hey, that almost went viral, James.
That being said, businesses could benefit from KPMG, who are here to bridge that gap. They combine strategy with powered delivery to move you from caution to confidence. It's more than just about software. It's about workforce adoption and responsible governance. KPMG helps you make the difference by ensuring AI delivers real business impact at scale. So you don't just listen to AI having a clue every week and keep up with the hype, but actually lead through it.
Although you definitely should still listen to AI having a clue every week.
Yeah, of course. Find all the resources you need at kpmg.com/UK to see how you can help your organisation scale.
If I think about other groups as well, I know that particular essay focused on women. You've also written about young people. We covered it on the podcast. You know, all of these graduation ceremonies, Eric Schmidt, you know, former CEO of Google there, you know, talking about AI in this way, you know, the great revolution, and yeah, you know, they're booing them off stage. Young people in particular are quite discerning when it comes to AI.
Yes, they can spot it.
Is that just about a jobs thing in that, you know, effectively the narrative is that this is a technology that's going to make things harder for you to get a job and have a career? Or is there, do you think there's something else at play as well?
I think it's a number of things. I think, first of all, young people have much more information than they did maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. They have all their different cores, their different universes within the internet, their different kind of tribes. And so this whole broadcast of an idea doesn't work as well as it did in the past. Mm. So I just think a lot of young people have more of a point of view than before. So that's one side of it. I think as well, the social contract that used to exist around, okay, you work hard, you do your degree, you get a nice job, that's been shattered. And they already know that. And then now you're having these kind of tech bros come into their graduate saying, it's going to replace you, but hey, just jump on the ship. You know, they're seeing through the nonsense. So I think it's jobs. I also think it's creativity as well. You know, a lot of young people are very creative. And then you're also pushing the use case that it's going to replace artists. It's going to replace writers. Mm. And we do live in a kind of information age where people are making a lot, living online by being content creators, and you're seeing all these avatars and fake people talking. So they're just like, I don't believe you. Why are you coming to my graduation and telling me these things?
The toothpaste is out of the tube on this, but if you could rebuild AI, or you could sort of think about it in a different way, how would you sort of build it from the ground up? What would you do differently to what the things that we've kind of got now?
So I don't actually think we need to rebuild it. I just think more people need to adopt it and basically move it away from the tech bro story of it. This is a technology. If you look at how they built it, it was based on neural networks. Neural networks, the way our brain works, is like mycelium. We seem to think we're separate from nature, but actually all of nature have the same pattern of branching. And what is happening right now is we have one kind of group of people saying, this is the only way through this vast network. But actually, if you had more people just doing their own different, diverse, weird things with it, you can actually get more ways through. You move away from the dominant pathways to the more sparse pathways. This isn't really a mechanical tool at all. Yeah. This is why the medium framing is very important. It's not like TV where you had to have a broadcast channel or you had to have telephone towers or things like this. All you need is a computer. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some people don't have that, but you know, people who do have a computer and a internet connection can actually form a node on this thing and create something that other people can follow that takes them away from this tech bro story. So really the answer is what I call adoption, not adoption in the sense of jumping on the tech bro program about AI, but adoption almost as if you're raising the AI yourself to do something else. So I actually just think the more people use it in a way that's not that mainstream story actually changes the direction of the whole thing.
You've seen sort of behind the curtain of, you know, some of the biggest technology companies in the world. You talked about that whole slew of interviews that you did talking to women. Are you, given all of that, are you hopeful about the future of AI?
I am hopeful about humanity. I personally think what's going on with AI right now with the tech broligarchs, I feel like what they're trying to do is create some kind of machine god thing AGI. And that's what all the money is for. The money and the data centers are really just to make this powerful machine type of thing. I don't think that drive is based on logic or anything, or even to help people. I just think that's what they want to do. So my whole thing is, I don't have hope for them. I think they should go off and do what they're doing. My whole thing is education for people not to be susceptible to their message, because the whole thing with these tech guys, they need your permission for it to work. It's a bit different from maybe empire logic from the past, where it's more violent on your physical person or on your land, or, well, it is a bit on your land for data centers and things like that, but it's really the kind of power over your mind and where you put your attention. I'm very hopeful in the young people. I'm hopeful in the people who are actually skeptical about AI, because they have a discernment, you know, they're having a critical lens on these things. And those are the people I think should be shaping. So the reason why I write the way I write, because it's very mytho-poetic, you know, I'm talking about, you know, mythology in one section, and then I'm talking about geography, then I'm talking about mycelium, then I'm talking about goddesses. I'm trying to attract people who think in humanities, or people who are neurodivergent, or even just people who understand, who are from marginalized audiences, because they are the people who can actually turn this thing around, because they're not in the mainstream and they will have more viewpoints. They're the ones actually most impacted by the huge averaging power of AI. And so they're the ones that need to be kind of shaping it. A lot of them are skeptical at the moment. So really my job is to, I guess, teach them that they do have agency. It's not all over. But I think there is a kind of short window before they kind of suck up all the power on this. So really that's my whole thing, is how to kind of get people who have a point of view and have a different way of thinking to shift the direction of this thing. Because if we don't, it's going to go the way they want it to go, essentially.
Yeah. We play this game, ChatGPT Roulette. We basically look at the last thing that you've punched into your LLM of choice, and we share it. Ours are very, very boring. So you're going to have something way more interesting. What is your LLM of choice, and what's the last thing that you asked it?
I have many for different reasons. I don't actually, I'm not loyal to any one of them. I'd say I use Claude and Perplexity the most. The last thing I did search was, I use it a lot for research. So what were the biggest fears people have around AI? Because I'm actually doing a course to help people understand how to use it.
Yeah, nice. Mine, how many zeros in a trillion? Turns out it's 12. Who knew that?
Were you thinking about the Elon Musk being a trillionaire thing?
Yeah, how much money is Elon made since we started recording this episode of the podcast? It's very sad but true. Abby, thank you so much for giving us some time. We'll put a link to your brilliant book and Substack in the show notes as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful speaking with you.
Well, that was delightful. What an interesting chat that was.
Yeah, and you know, we said in the intro, you know, she's not all glass half full. I mean, you know, certainly not. I mean, I think she's highly skeptical, highly critical of AI, not just from the point of view of gender and how it, you know, slightly misrepresents women's whole role in taking on AI, how they feel about it. She talks so much about that ick that women have, but I think any kind of marginalized minority groups, AI just isn't sort of really there for them. You have to work kind of so much harder. We've heard this before, people like Zara Chatu, who's come on, Dr. Lauren Abraham, and yeah, it was just a different perspective from Abby. I really, really enjoyed it, and she's got all the creds as well. She's seen under the bonnet of lots of these companies too, so a thoroughly enjoyable conversation.
James, what was your one big takeaway from chatting with Abby?
I think we all have to hold this level of skepticism when we're using AI. We're not handing everything over. We're not just offloading everything for AI to do it for us. We have to treat it like a sparring partner. We have to sort of almost use it and abuse it to get what we want out of it. It shouldn't start replacing what we're doing. And I think we're hearing that again and again and again. Leanne at KPMG talked about that sort of cognitive offloading, the idea that you just sort of give AI everything and you lose the ability, that muscle memory, to think yourself. So yeah, it reinforced a lot of the stuff that we've heard before, and lots of my own thinking as well. Yeah, she was great. She was really, really good.
Lovely job, James. Thank you again to Abby. That is all we've got time for on this week's edition of AI Haven't a Clue. I say this week's, we're back on Friday. More of us, I'm sorry. Thanks so much for listening and enduring us. If you've got a listener question or, I don't know, a weird AI story you'd like to share with the show, you can, of course, as always, drop us an email at aihaventaclue@gmail.com. We'll be back on Friday. Don't forget, subscribe, share the show with friends, rate us, all that good stuff. But for now, James, remember...
Stay curious and stay cool.